This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris with a musical to-do list. It's a new book called 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. The author is Tom Moon, one of our regular music commentators. It's a big, fat book, about 900 pages. From Marian Anderson to ZZ Top, the book covers all genres and is driven by what Moon calls the notion that the more you love music, the more music you love. Tom says 1,000 was not an easy number to settle on.
It was very hard because I didn't want to have a standard criteria, but almost everything had to hit me on like the pleasure level. It had to be pleasurable music. It had to be beautiful. It had to be moving. And that helped clarify the list a little bit.
It would be almost impossible to do justice to all the music listed in this book in the time we have on this show, so we asked Tom to help us put together a playlist of songs that represent a late summer soundtrack, the kind of thing you'd listen to during those last backyard barbecues or during the waning days at the beach. And the first song that Tom suggested is Poinciana, a classic jazz cut from Ahmad Jamal. This was recorded live in 1958.
Ahmad Jamal is one of the great Zen masters of jazz piano. He plays just what is needed and nothing more. Every phrase is perfect. Miles Davis was a huge fan after this record, Live at the Pershing, became a hit. It was actually on the charts for 107 weeks. And I love this as a summer record, too, because it shows the power of music. This was actually recorded in January in a club in Chicago. So they have this open, sauntering vibe, and they're probably freezing when they finish the set.
Now, I want to include an album that for many people was the soundtrack of summer in 1969. The album Stand by Sly and the Family Stone. An amazing achievement here because 7 of the 9 cuts were all hit singles.
And like all of Sly's singles, they all feel like summer. They have that radiant sense of urgency to them. It's like he's taken the basic workings of Motown and amped them up about 10 notches. The band is on fire. These guys really captured the spirit of summer music, I think.
Now, we could choose almost any track on this album, but what, to your mind, is the standout cut?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I like I Want to Take You Higher because it just throbs. It feels like you're looking at the pavement and it's just vibrating and you're feeling the steam rising off of it. Beat is getting
fantastic horn section.
Everything. And it has the thing that so many of the great singles did from Sly, which is that everybody gets a turn as the lead vocalist. And they just sort of go around robin and get the great bass voice. You get all the different personalities that made up that band. And, you know, when you think about pop music at that time, it was about different personalities. And you really felt like you were looking at an aggregate of people that were individuals and worked together. And that's a great thing. And they were so unified. God, what a band.
Now, Tom, our next choice may be obvious. I was thinking about Vivaldi's Four Seasons.
Yeah. It's obviously a classic. There's a section devoted to each of the four seasons. And when played the way it's played by Janine Jansen, the violinist, and a small chamber group, each of the seasons is really completely nailed. They really get inside what it means to be in that thick of summer. And summer is my favorite part of this piece because it does feel like August, and it does feel very thick, and it starts off in a very slow mood, and it becomes more playful as it goes along. But you've sensed that when these guys recorded this, they were thinking almost heat, humidity, that thing you just can't escape even if you're in air conditioning.
Tom, it would seem just wrong if we put together a late summer playlist and we did not include Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, he's one of those people, and his record, Born to Run, is one of those records where no matter what time of year you put it on, it sort of brings you back into that thing where you're out on a summer night and you can do anything.
With a cool of graces and a sea. Places that no can fill.
I think, you know, as we approach the end of summer, I always get that thing of, oh, I've got to grab onto every minute of this great weather and this inspiring air. And then I realize that it's inside these records. One great thing about this project has been the ability to go back and rediscover and learn more about records I thought I knew well. And the Born to Run story is a good one like that, because there was a documentary that was packaged with the 30th anniversary edition of Born to Run called Wings for Wheels. And in that, Bruce talks about what his conception was for this record. And it totally makes sense. He says, Born to Run has that feeling of that one endless summer night. That's what the whole record feels like. It could all be taking place in the course of one evening in all these different locations, all these different stories on one sort of long summer night.
Whoa, she's the one. She's the one.
Tom, it's been great to talk music with you. Thanks so much and congratulations on the book.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Moon. His book is called 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, A Listener's Life List. You can read and hear more essential summer songs from his book at the music section of NPR.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Delegates are starting to arrive in Denver for Monday's start of the Democratic National Convention. And as you might imagine, a campaign has been orchestrated to enhance Colorado's image. So we asked our Denver reporter, Jeff Brady, to show us the real Colorado. He came up with a list of 5 things delegates should do but probably won't.
Number 1 on the list, watch a cattle drive through downtown Denver. We're talking the real thing here with cowboys on horseback, long-horned cattle. This happens every year at the start of the National Western Stock Show. Sadly, a cattle drive planned for the convention was nixed by some high-profile opponents, among them William Dean Singleton, publisher of the Denver Post. One of Singleton's reporters, Chuck Plunkett, explains.
He felt like that would make Denver look like a cow town, that you bring in the national and the international media, and the first image that they get, literally as they're getting off the plane, they've had a little chance to wash up and relax, and now suddenly all these cows are coming down the street.
But never fear, there's another chance to see livestock associated with the city, and that brings us to number 2 on our list. View one of Denver's city-owned bison herds. Denver's Parks Department has about 90 bison grazing hilly fields just outside of town. The city started the herds nearly 100 years ago as a conservation effort. For those who like their livestock on a plate, there's number 3 on our list. Eat 3 kinds of unusual meat, preferably in one sitting. And the best place to do that is at Denver's oldest restaurant, the Buckhorn Exchange, where you'll find co-owner Bill Dutton.
While we do serve great beefsteaks, we also feature things like rattlesnake and yak and ostrich and buffalo and elk. Most of these animals you can actually see hanging on the walls while you're enjoying them.
And make sure you leave room for one of the region's signature dishes.
Our most popular appetizer is Rocky Mountain oysters, which are not seafood. There's a number of ways to describe them. The south end of a northbound bull.
And I guess proof that anything, as long as you fry it, is going to taste okay.
That's actually things like the alligator, yeah.
Next is number 4 on our list of 5 things delegates should do in Colorado but won't.
Get out of Denver and take in some of the real scenic beauty of the state.
That's Hal Walter. He's a writer and lives about 3 hours' drive outside Denver in the mountains. Walter says you'll find some of the best fruit you've ever eaten in the more rural parts of Colorado.
Get over to the western slope, maybe eat a Palisade peach, or head to the southeastern corner of the state and have a Rocky Ford cantaloupe.
Both are conveniently in season during the convention. That brings us to number 5, climb a 14er. That's a mountain that exceeds 14,000 feet in elevation. Colorado has more 14ers than any other state. The obvious choice for delegates is Mount Democrat in central Colorado. But for the less ambitious, there's Mount Evans, which has a road all the way to the top. That's where I found Joe Leahy from Denver, who pointed south to Pikes Peak about 50 miles away and then looked east.
Oh, I think I see Dorothy over there in Kansas flying around. I mean, you can see the curvature of the earth from up here, too, on a clear day.
Now, if you're traveling from one of those blue states on the coast, you may want to spend a few days in Denver before traveling up to the mountains. Changing altitude that quickly can leave you ill and unable to appreciate the natural beauty and western heritage of Colorado. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
For tips on avoiding altitude sickness while listening to airy speeches, go to NPR.org. The urban historian Witold Rybczynski spent years writing a book about the building of a single housing development.
I wanted to write about the process of how a new community is made.
He wrote about an exurb, a neighborhood proposed in the countryside more than 50 miles outside Philadelphia.
It made sense 7 years ago when the idea was first floated because the market was so strong.
Now, of course, the market is not. This case study of development at the urban fringe has become a case study of lowered expectations. That's a subject for The Urban Frontier, our series on how the world's cities develop and grow. In American cities, the fastest changes often come at the edges of metropolitan areas, like the one we've been describing this week. So we're driving along U.S. Highway 1, and we are moving into one of the great urban concentrations of the world, a megalopolis that stretches from above Boston down the East Coast to New York and other cities down to Washington, D.C. One edge of it is here, Chester County, Pennsylvania, where we have housing developments alternating with cornfields. We had Witold Rybczynski's book in the back of the minivan. It's about changing a Pennsylvania cornfield into a community. So it's called Last Harvest. It traces Chester County's development back to the man who founded Pennsylvania in the 1600s.
Well, the county was really part of the lands that were given to William Penn, which was essentially a real estate deal.
The King of England gave Penn thousands of acres to settle a debt. Penn gave much of modern-day Chester County to his relatives, who were hoping to profit from it.
Which is important, I think, for people to understand that development isn't something that we invented. Real estate development is here from the beginning. Virtually all the founding fathers were also developers, because the only thing of value in the New World at that point was land.
One of the founders, George Washington, that one-time land surveyor, won the Revolutionary War, but lost when he tried to do a real estate deal. So if today's development in a Chester County cornfield should lose money, developer Jason Duckworth can at least console himself that there are centuries of precedent.
I have, you know, quite a few friends who are not in my industry, and they, you know, of course, turn to me, you know, they see me around the neighborhood and say, so how are things going? And I'm like, every bit as bad as you think.
We walked with Jason Duckworth through the neighborhood his father started 7 years ago.
Why don't we head down this way? kind of an unusual design strategy.
His company tried not to let it look like so many other subdivisions you've seen.
It's interesting. For the most part, this type of development in Pennsylvania is illegal. The conventional zoning in Pennsylvania usually mandates half-acre minimum lot sizes. And
big spaces between houses.
Big spaces between houses and doesn't require sidewalks.
That's the first thing you notice about the development called New Daleville, at least the parts that are finished. Local officials allowed the houses to stand just a few feet apart. You can walk the wide sidewalks and get to know your neighbors. Building in what's called the neo-traditional style means two kids have a smaller side yard for playing wiffle ball, but their mom, Julie Pappas, has a Victorian front porch.
This was what sold me, just the front porch and the tin roof.
And this is an interesting feature, too.
The little picket fence. So we have this nice little courtyard.
Okay.
Yeah. Right here is an older couple. These three houses are younger couples with younger kids. So it's really a nice mix.
The mix is so nice that Julie Pappas can almost forget that she is 50 miles from her job as a medical researcher. She can almost, though not quite, forget that her family took months to sell their old house after moving here.
We put it on the market, I want to say like $350, and we sold it for $300.
Ooh. After eating an extra year of mortgage payments.
That's why you don't see any furniture in the first two rooms of my house.
Construction began in this development just as the national real estate market started to collapse. New Daleville is only about half built. Dozens of home lots stand vacant. Developer Jason Duckworth and the building company say they have no choice but to keep going.
We get bank financing for the site improvements, and we're committed to keeping things moving in this community so we have the ability to repay them.
Whether these houses move right away or not.
Exactly.
So they better move.
They better move. Right here on this boulevard, we have a home that sold for more than $500,000.
Just a couple years ago.
Just a couple years ago.
And now I can get something?
$280,000 to $300,000 will give you a new home in New Daleville.
How about $250,000? $240,000? $240,000?
I'll have to take you in and see if she can make a deal with you.
Jason Duckworth says the builders can keep throwing up houses, as this construction crew is doing now, because the neo-traditional design keeps some buyers coming. That design is not dead, though parts of it are slipping away. The plans called for elegant brick facades on the houses. Instead, almost every home buyer chooses vinyl siding, which is cheaper. Jason Duckworth says the buyers are also picking smaller floor plans.
The homes have actually come down in square footage, and it's generally the smaller models that are selling better at this point.
People are choosing more modest lives at the frontier of this giant metropolitan area. Some people in New Daleville are stuck with their choices. Consider Diane and Paul Roberts, who let us step up to their porch to watch an afternoon rainbow.
That's one of the things we do like out here is at night you get an unbelievable star pattern. The sky is much clearer. And a lot of ducks are flying through here, and it's really country.
Which is the upside as well as the downside. The space where New Daleville's developers plan for a coffee shop or ice cream parlor is still a vacant lot.
Yeah. This is, to me, is very rural. When you have to go 4 miles to go get a carton of milk, that's rural to me.
The Roberts retired early. They're on a fixed income, so they feel it when it costs more to drive the car. Ex-urban residents pay more to get rid of sewage and even to heat the house.
The homes in this neighborhood are heated by propane. Therefore, the cost of the heat is directly affected by the cost of a barrel of oil. If I had known that, we never would have bought the house.
But if you're out here in the rural areas, you don't have the gas lines.
If you had this choice to make over again, you would not make this choice.
I don't know.
I would not.
You would not. I guess it's just what you like and how much the economy is going to make your decision for you.
The man who wrote a book about New Daleville says its problem is simple. In this economy, it's just a little too far out, even for Chester County, Pennsylvania, where everything is far out. Yet Witold Rybczynski also noticed something when he drove out here to see us. A few cornfields away, he saw that workers were preparing the ground for some entirely new housing development.
Developers are gamblers and incredible optimists.
And a little economic trouble has not stopped the sprawling development that started so long ago with William Penn. We're on the urban frontier, our look at developing cities. You can hear yesterday's report from Chester County and earlier stories from South Asia at NPR.org. On Monday, we'll return to Chester County to ask how its development may be changing its presidential politics.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Now a story about a young man who has succeeded against the odds. His name is Jesse Jean, and we first met him on this program when he was a teenager. He was failing 10th grade, and his future looked bleak. That was when two women assigned to tutor him arranged for a scholarship to a boarding school. They told him that was his only hope to get through high school. He went in 2001, and he hated it.
It was everything different, none that I knew. Waking up early, your day is pretty much scheduled. You have to do what they say you have to do. And I ain't used to people telling me what to do, so naturally I had a problem with that.
Still, Jesse Jean stuck with it, and his tutors stuck with him. One became his legal guardian, and this summer he graduated from college. Independent producer Katie Davis has known Jesse since he was 12 years old. She brings us up to date on his story.
Ask Jesse to see his college diploma, and he climbs up to the third floor of the house he now shares with his old tutor in Alexandria, Virginia. He keeps it in an antique trunk in his room.
This is what $40,000 a year looks like.
Jesse doesn't point out that he graduated with honors from Ohio Wesleyan University, and that he had a double major. He is always understated when he's teasing or remembering when no one saw his potential.
As a youngster, I mean, you know, I went to various different schoolings, and those I've, you know, been told that, you know, you'll never amount to anything, you know, you're not smart enough and all of that stuff. Me being the type of person I am, it kind of motivated me.
Jesse began to react against expectations, against what he saw in his chaotic home and neighborhood. Jesse grew up here on 17th Street in Washington, D.C. Drug dealers, some of them relatives, anchored the street corner, and a police camera pointed at Jesse's house where he lived with his grandmother. He was in the middle of what Jesse called a thug mentality.
I just knew whatever was going on around there was not for me.
This was Jesse's survival plan. Stay in his room and play video games, all night if he had to. When his grandmother and uncle started drinking, leave. Walk past the dealers, eyes down. Just get up the block, right here, to the door of the local teen center.
Because around here was where all of the possibilities and opportunities were. Just right around the corner from me, and my mindset was, well, if they're available right around here, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to get from there to here.
Jesse visited his old neighborhood a lot this summer. On this day, he sits for a bit in front of the old teen center, and two friends saunter by, and then one of his older cousins.
I'm good, how are you?
The cousin pulls out a photo. Her son also graduated. Two black men with college diplomas.
My soul rejoices to know that, okay, y'all did what y'all had to do. Y'all keep doing what you have to do, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
It's not where you came from, it's where you're going.
Absolutely.
You know, where are you going?
Absolutely.
Jesse spent his college years thinking hard about where he came from and how he avoided what seemed like a predestined life of violence and crime. His mother and father died in a murder-suicide. Two favorite cousins went to jail. Others got high every day. Not Jesse.
It was described in me when I was born that I wasn't afraid to go against the grain. I wasn't afraid to not have people accept me fully. And at a very young age, I saw exactly how I didn't want to live and how I didn't want to turn out. So, and, you know, when I made those decisions to do something differently or not go with the grain, I mean, there was times where I was alienated, but at the same time, I expected that. But that didn't deter me from my goals.
Do you think that made you a loner?
Absolutely, to a certain extent. And I've had many years of being a loner, you know, and it was protection mechanism for me.
Jesse knew this in his gut. But still, when he reached Ohio Wesleyan University, he wanted to know why. That led him to choose anthropology and sociology as his major, the study of human behavior. Why, for instance, did Jesse's sister and brother drop out of school, but not Jesse? How was he able to accept the help from his tutors, Terry Ellison and Toni Husted, two white women from a very different world? Terry and Toni watched Jesse as he unraveled this.
It was just so beautiful to watch, you know, that curiosity of learning. And I think so much of what he ended up studying at college helped him.
We have had some incredible discussions of man and the difference between inheritance and environment and a lot of those things. I mean, he has been able to put his own situation in a scientific context.
The more Jesse read, the more questions surfaced. What about his father, who in one terrible moment killed Jesse's mother and then himself? Is violent behavior passed down? That was how his grandmother and uncles treated Jesse, accusing him of being just like his father.
I mean, there's a lot of different theories on why that was the case. And the one that I feel like is most relevant to me in that situation was because, you know, they were understandably angry. And to a certain extent, I was scapegoated. I was the scapegoat. And so, which is understandable at the time. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating what happened or what took place, but it has allowed me to understand why.
And when it came time to write his college thesis, Jesse chose to study neighborhood teen centers. He argued for more funding and volunteers because they can and do change lives. Now his thesis is packed away with his diplomas and basketball awards.
I'm anxious about finding a job, and because, you know, everything gets real now. Everything has been real, but, you know, you got a lot of stuff you got to be responsible for, and I'm a little bit nervous.
Jesse has a new briefcase and the book Job Hunting for Dummies, gifts from his college girlfriend. She's a kindergarten teacher in Charlotte, North Carolina, and that's where Jesse is looking for a job. And when he gets his first paycheck, Jesse will pull out the budget spreadsheets that Toni, who he now calls Mom, made for him.
She did one for, if I was to make $40,000, then $35,000, and then $30,000, and then she has...
Ed, Toni's husband, comes in with the mail and shows Jesse the cover of the New Yorker magazine, a graduate heading out into the world with a rabbit's foot dangling from his cap, and they chuckle together. Yes, there was some luck. Jesse knows this was in the mix, along with the theories of human behavior. So little of his story has been predictable. What if he never walked up to the teen center and met the two women who have now become his family? Here is Terry, his other mother.
Well, and that's it. I mean, if you think about all the basic things you need as a child to develop to your potential, whatever that is, and how many of those things have been missing throughout his young life and really into his early teens, and who had to pull in, you know, how did he survive? I mean, that's what I always think to myself. Geez, I mean, you know, how did he make it to us? And good for him.
Terry says, you know, we have to figure this out, how Jesse got to us, so we can make a map for others.
That was independent producer Katie Davis. She lives in Washington, D.C. You can hear her stories about Jesse Jean from 2002 and 2004 at npr.org.
In healthcare, as in politics, it can be said that no battle is ever really over. About a decade ago, health officials declared an end to measles in the United States. Now that's changed. 131 cases of measles have been reported so far this year, and that is already more than three times the number of cases reported for all of last year. NPR's Patty Naiman has more.
Dr. Jane Seward with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the dramatic increase in measles is a potent reminder that we are still at risk.
Measles, although it's not, you know, transmitting in every community all year round anymore, it's just a plane right away.
Because it's easily transmitted when people cough and sneeze, Seward is an expert on viral disease.
there are 20 million cases in the world, and anytime people travel who are not protected through vaccination, they can bring it back if they go, you know, to a country where measles is occurring.
And once the virus gets here, Seward says, it's increasingly finding its way to American children who haven't been vaccinated.
Mainly among children whose parents have chosen not to have them vaccinated, and a high proportion of those children are homeschooled children.
Seward points to one of the outbreaks from 2008 as a prime example.
I think all the school-age children affected in Illinois were homeschooled children, and none of them were vaccinated.
Parents say they're afraid of side effects from the vaccine. Some believe there's a link with autism. But the National Academy of Sciences and the CDC say there's no scientific evidence for a link with autism. And Dr. William Schaffner with Vanderbilt University's School of Medicine says the vaccine is safe. At the same time, he says, measles is a devastating disease.
Before we had a vaccine in this country, there were 400 deaths of children in the United States each year caused by measles. It is a serious illness, and to be cavalier and not vaccinate one's child against measles shocks a person such as myself who has seen the devastating effects of this disease.
If a child is not vaccinated and they get measles, they put vulnerable children at risk. Those who cannot tolerate the vaccine, for example, like children on chemotherapy or infants under the age of one. Four of the cases hospitalized for measles this year were infants. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
It is a Friday morning. We're heading into the weekend, which means it's time to hear from Morning Edition and Los Angeles Times film critic Kenneth Turan. The new movie in theaters this week is yet another sequel to a blockbuster, Hamlet 2. That's right, Hamlet 2.
What can I say about Hamlet 2 that its title doesn't already tell you? This is an unhinged, off-the-wall comedy. Yes, it's uneven, but the hits are so dead on that the misses don't seem to matter. Hamlet 2 comes to life because of the all-out performance of Steve Coogan as Dana, a high school drama teacher in Tucson who refuses to say die when his program is terminated. Instead, much to the astonishment of his wife, he decides to put on a play of his own.
Hamlet 2?
The deuce, correct.
Doesn't everybody die at the end of the first one?
It's about my troubled relationship with my father.
Dana brings the unstoppable enthusiasm of the Energizer Bunny to his love of acting and theater. Unfortunately, he's never been very good at either. The one bright spot in Dana's life is that he runs into his favorite actress of all time, Elizabeth Shue, deftly played by Shue herself, at the Prickly Pear Fertility Clinic.
Excuse me. I'm sorry to be so forward, but you look a lot like my favorite actress of all time, Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah, I am her.
I freaking... You were wonderful in Leaving Las Vegas.
Oh, thank
and
you.
So fabulously funny in Adventures in Babysitting, not forgetting Cocktail with Tom Cruise. What is he like? He seems totally great. What are you doing in Tucson? Oh, my God, I'm freaking out!
I'm actually a nurse now. I just, you know, got kind of sick of the business, you know? Sick of all the horrible people, and anyway, there's a real shortage of nurses out there, and I like taking care of people.
Oh my God, I didn't hear anything you just said because I'm too excited.
Hamlet 2 picks up steam with the mounting of the show. For reasons that are never quite explained, how could they be? Hamlet 2, the play, has Jesus as a pivotal character. The show's main production number, Rock Me Sexy Jesus, is really something to see. The father of one of the stars says, "I'm simultaneously horrified and fascinated." You'll know just what he means.
Ken Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. You can see clips from Hamlet 2 and read more on this week's movies, including a review of the art house sensation I Served the King of England, all by going to npr.org.